session starts a series of sessions this week on faith and popular culture. Today, a session called Pop Culture on Trial, featuring the Indigo Girls as a test case for our reflections, and I rushed in at the end to get set up, and so I didn't have a chance to play as much prelude music from the Indigo Girls as I wanted to, but just a little taste from one of their first hits back maybe 20 years ago. How many of you know the Indigo Girls already? All right, excellent. Let me start just by saying a little bit, this is a really dark slide, I'm not sure why, but it doesn't really matter. You don't have to see what's on the screen. If you can, it's fine. This is the Love Bomber. It's my favorite graffiti. Thank you. It's my favorite graffiti in St. Paul, Minnesota, where I live. And I just want to say a couple of things about what sorts of sessions these will be today and the ones following. The first is that they're interconnected but distinct, so you can feel free to come today and not come to any of the other ones. And hopefully you'll get something that's worth thinking about. You can also, does someone know how these backlights go off? I think there's a switch over here.
It's got the RS.
Some of them.
And I think it's a door.
But they're interconnected, so if this kind of questioning at the intersection of faith and popular culture interests you, there's a thread that goes through all of them, and so you can make some deepening sense one after the other if you're able to come to more than one. Wow, now we're really in the dark. It's a hard room to get adjusted, so. We'll be in the dark together, which means asking some questions, not knowing the way. These sessions are interconnected but distinct. They're life and death questions. You wouldn't necessarily think that questions about pop culture, about music, and so forth would be life and death questions, but I want to make the case that they are because they lead directly to places where life and death issues are at stake, and we'll get there by the end of our time today. And I'm making proposals about these questions of how to connect faith and culture, and so I expect you to question me back, to take the proposals and play with them in your own mind, to adopt them if they make sense to you, and to adapt them if they only make partial sense and you want to work with them further, and to just reject them outright if you think I'm totally going off a cliff and you don't want to follow. So they're proposals to make us think about how we connect faith to our daily lives, to the music that we love, to the movies that we go to. Peter Marty in the Bible study this morning was raising this kind of question. How do we have a life that's faithful, not just a religion that we attend on Sunday as a kind of duty, but a faith that actually makes sense of our daily life, of what radio station we listen to, of why we like the songs we like, of the kind of questions that we ask when we're coming out of the movie theater and reflecting on what we've seen. The last is, these are proposals about being in the world. And so here we are at Holden, sort of removed from popular culture, removed from the immediacy of the news and the internet and cell phones and all of that, and it's a place apart to reflect, but this reflection is for the sake of equipping us for the daily lives that we live here and outside the village. And it's really, I think, a mistake for us to think that we're escaping the world when we come here, because we all come totally bearing the world in our bodies, in our minds, in our hearts. And we bring all these artifacts of the world with us, our computers, our iPods. People have collected over the years movie collections and CD collections up here. And so the world is here in full force. And we hold it at bay a little bit so that we have a chance to reflect together, to breathe more deeply, to relax, to eat together and sing together. But nonetheless, even here, we're trying to figure out how do we live faithfully together. So that's a little bit about the set of sessions and what I'm after, the character of what I'm after, and what I want in terms of your, what I want to invite in terms of your engagement. For today, this question, pop culture on trial, I want to start just by setting in context a way of thinking about how to relate faith and culture. And H. Richard Niebuhr's famous book 50 years ago, Christ and Culture, offered a way of thinking about how to connect faith and culture. Many of you probably know of H. Richard Niebuhr. He was a really well-known theologian in the 20th century, and this book is maybe his most famous book. And in the book, he drew on a sociological tradition of taking ideal types, which by definition don't really exist in society, in our lives, but they're abstracted for the sake of argument, for the sake of making some clarifications in our thinking. And so he created these what he called ideal types of how faith and culture relate. And he listed five of them and did a chapter on each. Christ against culture, a very adversarial relationship between Christ and culture. Christ of culture, in a sense, a Christendom model where the church is sort of diffuse all through society. Christ of culture, which he thought of as a model where you think of what is natural being perfected and becoming what's supernatural, or what's earthly becoming perfected and becoming what's heavenly, but them coexisting at the same time. You might almost think of it in terms of the Roman Catholic, the old-fashioned Roman Catholic sense of the ordinary Christians and then the religious. Two tiers, natural and supernatural Christians. And then Christ and culture and paradox. Not separate, not one, but in a kind of ongoing tension. Asking of each other questions and continuing to struggle with one another. And the last, Christ transforming culture. A kind of redemption, almost a crusader kind of model, that Christ will eventually transform all of culture, but that hasn't happened yet, and so there's a battle going on. Do these types and this basic idea of making typologies of how Christ and culture relate make sense? Anybody have questions or comments about that, just as a framework for moving into what we want to talk more about? No questions yet. I haven't said very much yet. All right. So this is moving to the United States and some of our history and how we've worked as a nation. Not all of you. Maybe some of you are not people who are born and raised in the United States, and that's fine. We'll just use the United States as a case study that's deeply influenced many of our lives and is in a sense a place that has influenced the world because of our economic and political and commercial power. So John Winthrop, an early Puritan leader, came across... landed in Plymouth Colony, founded this community, and their whole idea was to escape religious persecution in England. And they wanted, in a sense, to have a society of the holy. And they thought by coming to this new land that they could have a fresh start, be free from persecution, and have that, as John Winthrop called it in his famous sermon on the way over, a city on a hill, a holy light to the nations, that would be a community of the righteous, of the saints, who could then be a witness to the world of what it is to truly be Christian. And so from very on, we have this, in Niebuhr's language, a sociological term, we have a version of church that's described as a sect, as a group that's electively joined. You're not just a part of it because you're born, but you have to choose to be a part of this community. And being a part of this community means you have to achieve a high bar of moral character and behavior. And there's clear dividing lines between who's in and who's out. The whole horrible history of witch burnings in Salem is an example of how tense and crazy that can get in a community where there are these strong divides between saint and sinner, good and evil, and it's important that you be on the right side of the line. So that sets up a perspective, in a sense, of Christ and culture being one, in terms of H. Richard Niebuhr's typologies. And they wanted this idea of Christ being one with culture to be the dominant model of their life here. Well, we all know that the unfolding of the history of the United States didn't work out that way. There was a long period of time in which there were established churches. Think about Connecticut, for example. Connecticut was officially a Congregationalist state. It was the official religion, and you had, up until the 1820s or 1830s, all these laws that required everyone, regardless of their conviction, to be obedient in a kind of Congregationalist-defined saintliness. Well, what happened after disestablishment and after the U.S. became a country and after this idea of freedom of religion, which we think of as the separation of church and state, it's not really that in the official documents of the United States, but it's a kind of protection for the freedom of religion and from the state being dominated by one confession or religious tradition. And so we get this moment where there's an image of now, instead of Christ and culture being one, this dominant sort of Protestant Christianity in America decides that transforming culture is what to do. And so we have this whole history of these moralizing movements. So Lyman Beecher, who was the governor of Connecticut at the time of the disestablishment, decided to create anti-drinking crusades, and he led anti-drinking crusades all over the country as an effort to try, through this Christ-transforming culture, to make an effort at fighting back against godlessness and sinful behavior. Well, so that, you could say, that sort of Christianity as a social movement trying to transform the culture in Christ's name lasted a long time. How many of you subscribe to the Christian Century? How many of you know about it? Many more, okay. The very name of that magazine came from this sensibility that Christ is transforming culture, and that's the job of the church, to transform culture. And so the Christian Century was supposed to be the century in which the goal was achieved, you know, and Christianity really made the country truly Christ-like, loving our neighbor, and so on. And James Dobson, who's the other end of my historical trajectory, is a psychologist and educator, and he was doing his psychiatry residency at UCLA Medical Center in Southern California in the late 60s and early 70s. And what he saw through the 60s was that this Christ-transforming culture had totally failed. That in his view, the debauchery of the drug culture, the free love culture, the sort of anti-establishment culture of the 60s showed that the Christian churches of this sort were just going in the wrong direction. And so there's this moment coming out of the 60s and 70s where Dobson said, we need to be against culture. Culture is a place of great danger for Christians. And so out of that, you get this whole set of Christian movements, the Moral Majority, for example, and other, the Christian Coalition, you know, this whole what we call the religious right, as this movement that's saying we have to be against all the problems in society. We have to fight against it and try and push back sin, push back evil. And James Dobson created this organization, Focus on the Family, which sets up for us, a particular example of how Christians are encouraged. It's not the only story, for sure, but a dominant story about how Christians should think about culture. And so just to set in context where I come into the story, I was in church group in the 60s, late 60s, early 70s, as a little kid and getting into to high school about the same time that Dr. Dobson was starting to do his radio shows. And when I went to youth group, we were told that rock and roll music was the music of the devil, right? And if you played a song backwards, then it would say, "Worship Satan," or something like this. And I remember my mom telling me that when she was growing up in the 50s, she put the radio under her pillow so she could listen to Elvis, because her parents absolutely refused to let her listen to Elvis because of his hips, you know? If you watched his hips, you might, you know, get pregnant or something. I don't know exactly what the worry was. But there was this worry that rock and roll and drugs and sex and anti-establishment all was a sign that culture was no longer godly, and that godly people had to resist that, to be over against that, and to be skeptical of that. And I began to be taught that in youth group. And when I was in youth group in the 70s, Christian rock first began to come about. Petra was one of the terrible, awful 70s Christian rock bands. I'm sorry if there are any Petra fans in the room. So this Christian idea of being over against culture decided, well, we can create our own subculture. And that's sort of what Focus on the Family did. They created this huge media organization oriented to families, and their basic idea was, we want to help families know what's safe, what can be trusted, how they can, in a sense, keep that line between the holy and the unholy. This quote from Dobson really just sets up his whole ministry and the aim of his organization. The culture, and especially the media, are, Dobson argues, destroying the moral fabric of Western civilization. So if you really believe that, then that's going to be a very motivating challenge to try and fight back against that. And they created this organization, a media ministry called Plugged In. They have a magazine that they publish that reviews films, video games, music, whatever's out, whatever's popular, they're engaging it, they're reviewing it. And they also have a website that's very popular. And what they do with this is they draw on a particular theological trajectory, which I began to sketch, and I just want to pause for a minute and talk specifically about Focus on the Family. Evangelicalism is a really powerful and dominant form of Christianity in the U.S., but there are different versions of it. And the particular version of it that informs Focus on the Family is rooted in the Nazarene Church. Any Nazarenes in the crowd? No Nazarenes.
Former Nazarene.
So help me if I get going the wrong direction on this. James Dobson is not a pastor, but he thought he would be a pastor, and he comes from a family of three or four generations of Nazarene pastors. And it basically comes from a holiness interpretation of Wesleyanism, a sort of conservative form of Methodism. And this is John Wesley here. And he had a particular understanding of how salvation works that lends itself to a particular way of understanding Christian life. And you'll see how this connects to the line drawing. And what it is, partly it's a reaction to John Calvin. And Luther was similar in some respects, who had this strong sense of predestination, that from the beginning of time the saved have been saved. And it's not up to us. We have no role in it. We're, in a sense, Luther said that our life as Christians is a passive life. We're recipients of grace. And Calvin took that a little farther in terms of specifying how many he thought God had preordained, not many. And that was very worrisome to people. But also, there was a response to this that said, well, doesn't it matter at all what we do? So Jacob Arminius was a critic of this Calvinist perspective, and he argued that free will does matter, and our choices do matter. And so Wesley is in that tradition of claiming human agency as an element in our salvation. And so preparing grace, he said, is kind of a common grace that allows for us to believe every single person can be saved. It's a kind of universal blessing of all creation. And on the basis of that, there's a justifying grace which is given to us if we choose to receive it. So there's a kind of meeting in the middle there that happens in the moment of salvation. And so we cooperate by reaching out to receive this. And that is the distinction between those who are saved and those who are not saved. And it's part of the reason why the Methodists have such a strong evangelical element as a part of their culture. And then sanctifying grace is our God-inspired ability, Holy Spirit-inspired ability to not sin, to choose. We can sin, but we have the possibility of not sinning because of the Holy Spirit in us. And because it's something that we've participated in choosing, and because we're working with the Holy Spirit not to sin, we have the possibility of sinning and falling back out of grace. In a sense, the strong idea of election that Luther and Calvin had meant that we didn't have a choice in being saved, but we also couldn't choose to be unsaved. We were claimed, we Lutherans might say, we are claimed in baptism once for all. There's no going back from that. This is popular in England. If you haven't seen them, they're de-baptismal certificates. You can renounce your baptism and then order online a de-baptism certificate. Well, you could do that, but Lutherans might say God never says no to that promise that's been made in baptism. This perspective would say, God would say, well, you turned your back. So you in a sense have separated yourself from the promise. So this is a very anxiety-filled possibility. And it requires a perspective that allows us to say, we need to be safe, we need to have Christian friends, we need to watch with care what movies we go to, what influences are influencing our children, because what's at risk is everything, not just a bad choice now. We could lose salvation by making the wrong choice. And so there's a kind of ultimacy to our action. And Focus on the Family fills that theological frame with their perspective, but they also, I think, fit into a general cultural worry of wanting your children to be saved. Who doesn't? And they want people not to be hurt, not to suffer. And they have, I think, a remarkable if you learn about how they respond to people, they have always had the sense that every single person who calls needs to have a personal response. And if there's a crisis, they immediately get transferred to a counselor. And so they have a very attentive pattern of response. And part of the reason that they're motivated to do that is because for them, so much is at stake. If you ultimately think whatever you do doesn't really matter that much, then you're not going to worry that much, because not that much is ultimately at stake. So in the context of this, Focus on the Family encourages a particular mode of engaging popular culture. How do they find out what's safe? How do they find out what's good to pay attention to?
Can I ask you a question? Just on that last slide. When you had an equal sign, Nazarene theology equals Holy Wesley's. I'm United Methodist, so I have a question about what you mean by that. Is that an equal sign?
No, it's just where it comes from. The Nazarene theology is rooted in a holiness interpretation of Wesleyan theology. So it's a particular way of interpreting what John Wesley was all about. And So I don't mean it's equal in some simplistic sense that it just holiness Wesleyan is just something I made up as a way to talk about the kind of Wesleyan theology that they've adopted as an orienting guide for their denomination. Does that make sense?
Uh-huh.
Okay. So Focus on the Family says the way we watch movies might be best compared to an autopsy. They treat a movie or a song or whatever like a dead cadaver, and they pick it apart, looking for disease, looking for a sort of list of things that could be stated in a sheet that reports on sort of the state of the health of this body. And when they go into a review of a movie or a review of a song or whatever, they have in mind certain kinds of diseases that they're looking for in the autopsy, and just name some of them. What do you think they're looking for?
Sex.
Sex. They're looking for sex, of course.
Sex, nutrient, drug content.
Drugs. They're looking for drugs.
Anti-authoritarianism.
Anti-authoritarianism. Yeah, they don't like Green Day.
Negative portrayal of Christianity.
Uh-huh. Negative portrayal of Christianity. What else might they be looking for?
Language.
Language? What kind of language? Foul language. Anything else?
Homosexuality.
Homosexuality, absolutely.
Teen pregnancy.
Abortion.
There's a, you could sort of think of it as a rock thrown into a pool. And there's a sort of core circle of things: drugs, sex, profanity. Then those connect to social issues, social problems, which a number of you have mentioned as a sort of second tier. And that shifting list of things represents for them what's wrong with society, why society is not godly. And it's rooted in a sense of their understanding of Scripture and of what the Christian life is about, and the dangers, the behaviors that we could be influenced into doing. So our actions are the focus of this checklist. What actions in this body that we're analyzing might influence us down the wrong path? So the focus is trying to decide if there's enough worry about misleading actions here that could put us at risk now and in terms of our soul, our eternal status. What do you think of that kind of mode of interpretation of a piece of art, a piece of pop culture, whether it's a film or whether it's a poem or whether it's a picture, whether it's a song? What do you just react to that idea that the way that they do their cultural analysis is like an autopsy? Maybe there's a coroner here. Anybody a coroner? No coroners.
Well, it's essentially paternalistic.
Paternalistic in the sense that
we're going to decide what's good for you.
Yeah.
And we have the truth on which to make that decision.
Yeah.
I think it reminds me of what Peter Marty said this morning about quantifying that which we are afraid to let go.
They totally quantify it. Absolutely.
But there's got to be a checklist or a chart or something that you can put all this art into.
Well, so that's interesting in and of itself. Just the fact that the aim is to quantify it. How many sex acts are in this? How many profane words are in this? And they'll say the number. I'll show you an example of a review in just a second. Other reactions to autopsy as a model for cultural criticism. Yeah.
Well, to me sounds a lot like control and taking any part of mystery, gift, enjoyment out of, you know, what is, what's been created. It starts just even the thought starts negative.
Yeah, that's helpful. The subtitle of today's, the first part of the title for today's session is Pop Culture on Trial. And it really is a sort of accentuation of the negative, the expectation of the negative, of death, the danger of death, actually.
But that's it, Chris. Anytime you're dealing with an autopsy, by conjecture, you're dealing with something that's dead.
Yeah.
And any artist that creates a song or a movie or whatever, I would think would think of what they created as something alive.
Yeah.
Something that's meant to be interpreted.
Yeah.
I thought about
it. Well, it's breaking it down into its tiniest bits, but then not reassembling it as a whole. I mean, you can take the tiny bits and say, this word is a foul word or a profane word, but that word alone is not the same as what the piece of art is as a whole.
Yeah.
So you're losing some of the meaning by breaking it down into the tiniest individual acts or individual words.
And you're breaking it down into individual acts and individual words that you've decided in advance are what to look for, without considering what it is that you're encountering at all. So I was talking to Peter Marty on the walk, and he gave me this definition of compassion, which he likes. We were talking about a session this morning. Is Peter here? Peter said, is a rabbi who gave him this definition, and it was basically encountering another and receiving from them who they are before the ideology that's in me decides who they are. And the reverse happens with the autopsy analogy. I don't know if ideology is the right word or not, but the set of convictions I have determines who I'm meeting before I've met who's there. So that's helpful the way you phrase that. Other responses? Somebody up here, yeah.
It seems to me that I have some questions about, maybe this relates more to psychology, but the questions about whether or not being exposed to some of those things is healthy, as opposed to not letting children who are the primary, we're trying to keep safe, so to speak, in these situations, not letting them be exposed to any of that profanity or sex would be more healthy than maybe giving them a taste of what's out there in the world. And I don't know if that's a question or just a statement, but that seems to me that there's a little bit of tension there.
Yeah, it presupposes that ignorance is safe.
Right. That if you're not letting them see any of that stuff in the world, that they just... Well, it's not allowing them to accept it, I guess, it's not allowing them to see that it potentially could be not totally horrible.
And then what happens to the judges?
Well, so that's a big concern on the blogosphere. Kids writing in responses to articles that the reviewers from Focus on the Family write, asking them, how do you cope? How do you keep yourself safe when you're constantly exposing yourself to all these dangers? Reviewing these movies and songs and stuff. And they actually say this autopsy analogy is one of the ways it's a distancing strategy. If I'm just in this analytical mode, it's harder for me to be moved by it or to have it affect me. They also say that when they're dealing with stuff they consider particularly vile, they pass around the duties so no one person has to do too much of a bad thing, I guess. That's interesting, though. Yeah. But this question of, I mean, at a base level, most people want, in a sense, want to have some discernment in terms of what their kids watch or listen to or whatever, and aren't going to necessarily say, oh, well, whatever, that's fine. You know, I don't need to really check out what it is. There's an impulse here, which many of us share, which is that everything's not equal, and we need some ways to make discernments about what this thing is versus that, and what would be good for my 5-year-old child versus what would be good for my 14-year-old child, and what kind of sharing of that with them do I want to do? Do I want to just give it to them and they go off and listen to it? Do I listen to it? This is what I want to talk about on Thursday, a sort of alternative way to envision how to do this kind of Christian engagement with culture that comes at it in a quite different way.
This takes away the ability to have a conversation with your kid about what's the content of whatever it is, poem, book, movie, you know, what they think about it, what do they see there, what do you see there, what do you find troubling. This just tells the kid, no, this is bad, you shouldn't read it or see it, but not doesn't allow a conversation to happen between the, or makes the conversation more difficult to have between the child and the parent about each of their point of view.
Let's try an example. Here's what folks on the family would say. They would say, for example, a child comes to a parent and says, oh man, I heard about this great new group. It's two women and they play acoustic guitars and they're really hip, and I want to get their new album. It's called Shame in the Sun. You know, they're called the Indigo Girls, and one of them's dad teaches theology, you know? And so then Focus on the Family would say, well, so you can come to our website and you can get our review and you can use that review to talk with your children about the Indigo Girls without having them listen to it, or without you even listening to it. And so here's what they would say about Shame in the Sun, which it was one of their more popular albums, 1997, hit number 7 on the pop charts. Pro-lesbian agenda, number one problem with this album. Speaking of sex in religious terms. They have a line about, I was speaking in tongues when I was with you that night. That's actually sort of lovely. From a certain perspective. We'll talk about that on Thursday. But interestingly, sex can be talked about positively very easily. It's very difficult to talk about sex positively. It's almost always a negative. Admitting to be halfway drunk, so here we've got sexuality, alcohol, and then one use of the F word. So they always count how many uses of profanity, almost like it's, you know, uses of, I don't know, as if you just pull it out of your pocket and use it 4 times. I'm going to use it 4 times in this song. So this is what they would do. They would say, talk about your children about all that's dangerous about this group. And then, you know, the child would then have, hopefully, some knowledge of it that would give them a sense that they should stay away from that. Because there are all these examples of categories where it falls short in Christian terms. Well,
Chris,
yeah.
Quick, this was objectionable to our kind of consensus view. The conclusion, meaning therefore one should not watch it, or is it the provision of information? I mean, obviously the information is slanted itself too, but I'm translating this in my own experience of movie reviews. A year ago, we were considering taking our 5-year-old and a 7-year-old to see Ice Age 3, which had listed all the different elements of this was violence, this was humorous violence, this was potty humor. And I found that it wasn't from Focus on the Family, but I found that information real helpful.
Yeah. So this is
so
part.
That's the question.
This, well, no, I think I use Focus on the Family because they're kind of a one end of a spectrum. But this kind of cultural criticism is very common. And it's very common around those basic reasons of wanting to have a shortcut to see some of what I might worry about that's there. And there are family websites that are sort of secular or just, they have maybe mainline or progressive Protestant slant. But the same sort of strategy without the particular theological perspective in play. And that's a that sounds like an example. Well, I want to raise a couple of questions about why this becomes a matter of life and death and not just a sort of bit of silliness about how some people make judgments about record albums. And the dynamic that's at play is a deep dynamic. I think it's certainly deep within American culture and history, but it has strands that go back through time and exist in many cultures. And one of the ways I have to talk about it is to think about the difference between unity and division. And living now in this age of technology, we have the opportunity to see ourselves from space and see the just wondrous unity that we are as a planet and the beauty of that. And it gives new meaning to scriptural stories that evoke the common humanity, the creation of the world and the sort of brother and sister unity of people. But throughout scripture there are these sort of indications that some people are chosen and others aren't, and some people are called to holiness and others aren't. And this is a picture of the Bethlehem Gate in Israel-Palestine. And this taking of a unity and then creating certain kinds of divisions so that some people are holy and other people aren't. And you know that you're holy because you know what defines those who aren't holy, immediately leads to drawing lines between us and them. And it very often leads to building walls. And this is the beginning of dinner, so we have about 15 minutes left. But if you're very hungry, feel free to go. It leads to building walls. And what happens when you enter into that framework of a division of holiness and evil or ungodliness is this danger of building walls on which the enemy resides on the other side. And when the other person is not holy, and God is not on the other side, God is on our side, and the other person is the enemy, then we know immediately the kinds of things that happen. I mean, this example, Israel-Palestine, is one among many places in the world where we could talk about the death and destruction that comes from deciding the other side is expendable. This picture of kids playing on a bombed-out building in Gaza as one example of just wanton destruction. We're going to talk tonight about President Obama's Nobel Peace Prize speech in one of the sessions and talk about different angles of view about war and peace and what it is to consider war seriously and how we get to the place where we can actually consider killing other people for the sake of our safety and security. So one of my worries about this is when we get to the place of saying, are they saints or are they sinners? Are they good or are they evil? Are they safe or are they dangerous? The possibility that we get to the place where this group can have death threats against them, where they can have violence perpetrated against them, because they've been defined as other. They've been defined as gay, or they've been defined as profane, or whatever. And they're Southern. They're from Atlanta, Georgia. And there was a specific incident where they were invited to play at a festival at a college as pop stars, but then it was someone leaked that they were gay and open and activists about a set of gay issues and supportive of gay rights and gay marriage and so forth, and there were threats against the college for having them come to sing, and threats that if they came to play at the concert that they would be at risk. And so that, it's a very, I think, it's a very easy step to say, I want to be safe. I want my kids to be safe. I want to make judgments that are sound and good judgments. But this very common and very dominant mode of making those decisions, that is saying, well, these things are holy and those things are not, opens the possibility of producing your own enemies, producing people who are expendable or who are, in a sense, outside the realm of God. Plugged In has this tagline, shining a light on pop culture. And if you think about that imagery, it implies that pop culture is dark, that there is no light there, and that we have the light. And we're shining the light there to try and determine what's going on. And it brings to mind images for me of police, of spotlights, and it raises these kinds of questions, I think. I want to close, we'll have a little more time for conversation, but I want to close just by asking the question, pointing forward into where we're going this week. What happens if instead of coming with our preset list of things to check, if we ask, who is this person? Who is this artist that I'm engaging? And what is their life? Who is it that I'm meeting in this work of art, in this piece of pop culture? So this is Emily Saliers talking about her life briefly.
I think obviously me coming out to my parents, it was not a surprise to them, because I was just a little girl, and my mom made my sisters Easter dresses, and I wanted Easter pants, so she made me Easter pants. So it was like the writing was on the wall, definitely. First time I ever kissed a girl, that was it. And now I'm curious about how to make movies. I was in a relationship at that time, and one of my sisters was aware of this friendship, and I think I just basically said, you know, we're more than friends, this is what it is, and I'm pretty sure I'm gay, and it was so loving and accepting, and it was never an issue, it didn't cause any discomfort. I was living with my parents at this time. And out of respect to them, I felt that since I was going out, staying out these late hours, and living this great, crazy, wild, young, first, newly gay life, going to the clubs and dancing and just living it up, that I owed them an answer for why I was staying out late and why I was maybe acting not totally myself. And so that's really what drove me. It was because I was living with them, and I felt that out of respect for them, I needed to share with them what was going on in my life. If I hadn't been living with them, I might not have come out so soon. And I told them separately, you know, I think I took them out to lunch at different restaurants. But I cried, I was very emotional. I felt fear because I didn't want to cause any problems. And yet in my heart, I knew that they would accept me. So it wasn't like this thing that took a huge amount of courage. It was just the trepidation that sort of rocking the boat in a family that had not had, you know, boat rock very much. They were so sweet. I mean, their main concern was that I would live a life that was difficult because of depression. And a lot of life has been because of that. But more than anything, they just wanted me to know that they loved me and supported me. Coming out just solidified the closeness I have, particularly with my family, and it made me own my own life, And I have been, after that, absolutely nothing to hide. You know, no skeletons in the closet, nothing. It's just me, and I was free.
The irony with the Indigo Girls in particular is that their family comes out of the same Wesleyan holiness tradition that Focus on the Family does. And there's a kind of, if you are able to stop and listen to what the Indigo Girls are up to, there's a kind of holiness ethic in their own work. They're so committed to justice and are always, in a sense, campaigning for organizations that are struggling, Native American rights, gay rights, the environment. They often have canned food drives at their concerts, and there's a kind of relentless Wesleyan holiness that's a part of their ministry, if you want to put it that way, as musicians. But without having somehow the compassion to set aside the checklist and come to the encounter open to hearing what's there, it's just not possible to meet whoever it is that's offering you the song or the movie or whatever, and see the complexity that's there. And that's part of what the next couple of sessions will try to begin to unpack, a theological view that allows us to open ourselves to the complexity that's there and begin to understand what that offers us as a way, a rich way, a deep and engaging way to engage the culture around us and to experience its full range, nice and nasty. So, comments, questions, thoughts as we wrap up?
I have a question, Chris.
Yeah.
The thing that I've noticed, first of all, thank you, excellent presentation. The thing that I've noticed about people I know who are big advocates of Focus on the Family for their kids is that they're also big fans of Fox programming, like shows like 24, and also there seems to be this big exception to the rule when it comes to violence against what has been defined as the evil empire.
Yeah.
And depicting Muslims as bad people. And it's just, to me, and also like pro-gun, I know someone in my life, we used to be really good friends, but she watches Fox all the time. And she now defines herself as an oppressed person because she's pro-gun and pro-family. Okay? So, but she defines herself as oppressed. And big Focus on the Family, and also big Fox News person.
It's an interesting turn of events to see evangelical Christianity and Protestant Christianity in general, which has been dominant all the way through our history, now feel oppressed and sort of structure their narrative as combative.
Mm-hmm.
We're fighting against this dominant secular cultural machine that's oppressing us. I mean, and it sets up all kinds of things like you're talking about. One of the things I want to talk about tomorrow in terms of celebrity is the way in which Fox News, you know, take your pick, so much of the way our media works offers people a sense to make meaning and sense of themselves and what's going on there. I mean, this is a great example, it sounds like, of someone whose identity has sort of fitted to the perspectives that she's engaging with on Fox, and that becomes what she says when she talks to other people.
Thank you.
Yeah. Other people. Yeah.
Flip side. One, it sounds like you can, from the Focus on the Family perspective, see the devil under every rock.
Yeah.
Is it possible also to see redemptive possibility under every gratuitous act as well? I mean, do we run into the danger of flipping over to the other side of the polarization of saying, well, that's a really gratuitous Kill Bill, perhaps, gratuitous movie, but don't we see that really the relationship is redeemed, and so let's follow through the 5 hours of the narrative, and I don't know, just to raise that possibility.
Yeah. Like, in other words, if not this, how do we say that's bad?
Is there a line at which where we might choose not to engage with, I use the word gratuitous because it can cover violence or some sort of wallowing, I was trying to imagine.
Yeah.
And even though we could rationalize a redemptive narrative within the gratuitous.
Part the question I want to leave you with on that, which I want to try and get at in more depth Thursday, is how is it that we go about knowing that in fact that's not good? So it's a process question, really. And the process is undergirded by certain theological convictions, I think. And this is a particular process undergirded by certain theological convictions, which really worry me. And I think there are other ways of raising the question, wow, you know, should we really recommend this? That come out of a different process. But I think it's really important to be able to do, because there's, you know, I have a 9-year-old and a 12-year-old, and there's crap out there I don't particularly want them to sit around watching while I'm, you know, cooking dinner or whatever I'm occupied doing. It's 5, it's dinner time. Thank you for coming and for engaging.